If you eat, you are involved in settler colonialism. Now, that thought might have stopped you mid-Bunnings sausage. It's a line from a new book. The author is Christopher Mays. Now, he's a research fellow at the Alfred Deakin Institute. The book is called Unsettling Food Politics, Agriculture, Dispossession and Sovereignty in Australia. And by the magic of radio, Christopher joins us now. Christopher, welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
These are big ideas in this country: agriculture, dispossession, sovereignty. This is the story of this post-colonial place.
Yes. Yeah. Indeed. I think the idea of the farmer and agriculture is very much entwined with our national character. And I think in the past and continuing into the present, there's been an idea that the backbone of our society is built on agriculture, riding the sheep's back. Wheat historically has been a source of economic strength, but I think there's been some people who have advocated for this is part of who we are as a nation, fighting a hostile environment to create a new flourishing society.
I mean, if we take it back to 1788 and the years immediately following, there are reasons why this would be central. I mean, here is a bunch of colonists and their convicts.
Indeed.
Had to feed themselves.
Yes.
And eventually agriculture became the first, as you mentioned there, with wool and wheat and so forth, the first economic driver of that post-colonial country as well.
And I think especially in those early years, which some historians refer to as the hungry years, I think is often sort of forgotten that for those first 5 years, the colony nearly starved to death. They were relying on supply ships. There were very few people with agricultural background who were coming out on the first fleet, and they didn't really know how to farm these lands, particularly around Port Jackson, were not very fertile soils. And there was a inability or a unwillingness to learn from the Gadigal people and to learn local food ways. And so those first few years of near starvation, and then with James Roos's farms out near Parramatta, I think set the tone for this idea that agricultural was this sort of almost salvation of the fledgling colony.
Well, and set the tone too for this ongoing issue of sovereignty, because as agriculture expands, so does the use of land, so does the conquest slowly of the continent.
And as they opened up that new farm out at Parramatta, they, along with James Roos and his farming, they sent the military out there to protect the small farm, which also instigated some of the first violent conflicts and clashes between Indigenous people and the settlers or invaders.
I mean, the great irony of those hungry years, as described, is if we look at the work of Bill Gammage or Bruce Pascoe, that description of an extremely intricate and productive rural agricultural economy being run by First Nations people in this country for millennia, into which come people with no capacity to see what surrounds them.
Exactly. And I think that capacity to see, I mean, it comes across in Watkin Tench's early diaries of those years, that on the one hand, they sort of held the Indigenous people with disdain and seeing them as barely existing, barely human, but on the other hand, also noticed that they were well-fed, leading a flourishing, happy life while they were dealing with scurvy and nutrition deficiency diseases.
Something
and all
not quite working out between those two views of the world. I mean, this is for people living in this country, this is a really interesting and important discussion. Mm. Why, though, did you particularly want to address this? Was there a moment of epiphany for you in coming to this?
For me, it came to some of the contemporary alternative food politics, the idea of a way to restore the land. We need to have small-scale farming that's no longer intensive and industrial, which arguably contributes to climate change. And listening to a lot of these activists and farmers and being quite encouraged by some of this food politics around rethinking the food system, but then seeing this blind spot around the role of agriculture Historically and continuing today in the dispossession of Indigenous Australians. So in talking about food justice today and rethinking a food system today, I think we need to put Indigenous justice and Indigenous sovereignty at setting the terms and conditions for that conversation. It can't be an add-on to the end of the conversation about food justice. We need to remember and have at the forefront of our mind that the lands that we produce our food on are lands that have been stolen.
I mean, that's an understanding of Australian past which should underpin so many conversations in this country. We talk about a republic all the time. How could you have a republic without an acknowledgement of previous sovereignty and so forth? In that particular instance, though, around food production and new ways of going about that, how does that shift with that understanding?
I think it shifts in a number of ways, particularly with broadening our understanding about that historical past. I think on the one hand, yes, in a range of areas we need to remember that we are involved in institutions that benefit from dispossession. But I think agriculture in particular had a specific role both as an evolutionary marker. So around the time of the settlement or invasion of Australia, the stadial theory of societal evolution was prominent. So
that's
the
idea
that a society evolves from hunter-gatherer to grazer-pastoralist to agricultural settler to mercantile. And so the view was that, well, these hunter-gatherers are not at a higher level of societal evolution. They don't have property rights, therefore they have no claim to these lands. And so in coming in and establishing settler agricultural practices, that provided a marker of property and justification for those dispossessions. So in remembering and thinking about the implications of agriculture in that history, I think for people who want to talk about food justice and a new type of agriculture, there is a very real way that new type of agriculture needs to address Indigenous dispossession today. So whether that's in collaboration with local Indigenous peoples or with work like Bruce Pascoe in reviving Indigenous foodways.
He would have a yam in every supermarket.
Yeah, there's those sorts of things that could...
I mean, this is a really interesting thing because and this is where, new ways of agriculture and shifting climate, for example, go hand in hand. Learning how to work productively with this land is a thing that increasingly we grapple with, and we look around New South Wales, we look around Queensland at the moment, we look around parts of Victoria, all drought-stricken. Clearly, the traditional post-colonial methods of farming are becoming increasingly problematic, and there may be great solutions in that, in a closer cooperation between new farming methods and old farming methods, ancient farming methods.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I think I am not a farmer by background at all, but people like Charles Massey and regenerative farming movements and techniques are starting to do some of this work in listening to local Indigenous peoples to collaborate and to think about how do those old practices and wisdoms and knowledges, how can we really take those into these newer forms of alternative food production?
I mean, it's interesting how both things are happening simultaneously. Big, increasingly corporatized farming ventures set against, new movements in radical sort of farming, and coexisting with that too is a really entrenched social notion of the farmer in Australian culture. This idea of the farmer as the most virtuous citizen is a thing that we see so clearly in our sort of social and political dialogue, and it's perhaps obstructive because perhaps it upholds certain practices that are seen as being virtuous that perhaps are no longer appropriate.
Yeah, and I think that there's not so long ago that Malcolm Turnbull on the floor of Parliament was talking about farmers as the ones with the best knowledge of the land and the best knowledge of the water in this country. And I'm, not here to dispute what farmers do or do not know, but that shows that immediate prejudice against Indigenous knowledge and against the intimacy of that knowledge of waterways and land and environment in this country, and this immediate valorization or promoting of the farmer knowledge as being the one that should be privileged in these discussions.
Which, you know, is such a strand in Australian cultural thinking, the idea of the Australian legend, you know, the man held together by fencing wire and baling twine. It's so deeped in our contrastingly urban culture that this is our sort of sense of self-identification.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, some social historians looking at this phenomenon both in the US and Australia, although Australia is more urbanized than the US, suggest that with the increasing urbanization, increasing detachment from these rural and agricultural contexts, there is a greater romanticization of that life as providing this kind of authentic foundation for who we are. Mm. So the farmer serves as providing this guarantee of true Australianness. You know, Don Watson in his recent book on the bush talks about the real Australians are the ones who live in the bush, the ones who have been able to tame this land. And I think that those myths and ideas need to be looked at in a different and more critical light about what actually happened, particularly during the periods of colonization in those places, and then thinking more forward today about how are we going to produce our food on stolen lands.
And yet, there is a truth in that, that true Australianism, whether this be through First Australians or whether this be through Australian farmers, is a sense of that connection, actual groundedness in actual ground. You know, urban life in this place could be urban life anywhere.
Yeah.
Farming life still is a thing of the place.
Yes. And that's the phrase about the farmer being the most virtuous citizen. Mm. Thomas Jefferson very famously talked about the virtue of the farmer, and primarily because they were grounded in the country, their liberty was attached to that land. And so if the English were going to come back and, you know, try to reclaim the colony, the farmer wouldn't flee to Canada in the same way that the city dweller could flee to Canada or just up and leave when going got tough. The farmer had put down literal and metaphorical roots into the land.
And I wonder if at this time now too, with all sorts of sort of institutional uncertainties, whether we are perhaps just drawn a little bit more in this present moment of many anxieties towards that steadying notion of the rural Australian, the great underpinning of the colonial culture.
Yes, and I think that you see it's primarily those with the economics and social means who tend to be living in urban spaces who decide to become tree changers or to maybe buy a property out in the Macedon Ranges or in, outside Sydney past the Blue Mountains to provide a little bit of that groundedness to balance out with their city unsettled life.
City being sort of intrinsically ungenuine somehow. It's an interesting thing, Christopher. Thank you so much. And look, these thoughts and many more expanded upon in Christopher's book, Unsettling Food Politics, Agriculture, Dispossession and Sovereignty in Australia. The author is Christopher Mays. Christopher, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Blueprint here on RN.